In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about how to get your first 10 SaaS customers. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 295. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
Do you want to hear a joke about tacos?
Always.
Are you sure? It's kind of corny.
Well, you know, it comes with the territory, right?
Get it? Corny. Tacos. Mm.
I was waiting for something funny.
I know. I don't know what you were expecting from me.
Oh, man. Yeah, that was pretty bad. I wouldn't even tell that one at MicroConf. That's how bad that joke is. Yeah, we were talking offline before this podcast, and it's like we don't have so much going. I mean, we have a lot going on, but none of it this week is that interesting, right? To do in this update up front. It's like there's behind-the-scenes stuff. You said you talked to a potential customer about early access stuff. I've been plugging away, having meetings, charging ahead, but I really couldn't think of anything in the last week that was that interesting to tell the listeners about. Some weeks are like that.
Yeah, it's not that there's not stuff going on. It's just like it's not really interesting to hear about at this point.
Yeah, well, so maybe today we dive right in to the topic of the day. We're talking about how to get your first 10 SaaS customers. And specifically, we're going to be referencing this blog post on the Parse Hub blog called How We Got Our First 10 Paying SaaS Customers. And Parse Hub is a SaaS app. They're a visual web scraping tool. So they have taglines like extract data from any site or turn any dynamic website into an API. And so obviously, if you sign up for them, you can go and it does screen scraping in essence, and then you can pull data out. I'm assuming you hit some Parse Hub endpoint, and then you can pull data through there. But they published a post. This is over a year old at this point. They had launched in September of 2014, and they published a post in 2015 about how they went through and basically from a standing stop. As far as I know, they didn't reference having a list or they didn't reference having an audience or any of that stuff. And so that's where I found it interesting is that these folks have done it recently. Relatively. They walk through, what is it, 5 or 6 steps that they took to do this. And we won't cover in detail everything that they talk about. We'll obviously link it up in the show notes, but we did want to kind of walk through some steps of how you might be able to kind of replicate what they've done to also get your first 10 SaaS customers. And so the first thing I talk about is don't rush. And the post mentions there's a lot of pressure to launch early and grow from day one, but premature growth can be detrimental to a small team that's not equipped to handle a large number of signups. And back to my voice here, not only can it be detrimental if you can't handle the support and can't handle the onboarding, but it can be detrimental if you have a product that nobody wants yet and you launch and people try it, and then they don't give you a second chance later on. Whether your product is just plain bad, if it's not built well, or if you haven't built something people want yet, it's going to be really hard to get the benefit of the doubt and get another try out of folks 6 to 12 months down the line once you actually have built your killer tool. And so Parse Hub in the post talk about how they didn't launch publicly right away, that they focused on finding a pain point. They solved one problem for one type of customer very well. And this is where having this early access, I called it the slow launch, right? I mean, drip launched over the course of 6 months in essence. We got customer number 0, and then customer number 1, and we figured out how do we build it till they get value, and then customer number 2. And we built up one at a time. And Parse Hub in essence did a similar thing where they really took their time to focus on finding a real pain point and solving it for one target customer type.
And I think in most cases, that's probably the way to go. If you don't have traction yet, you're not really sure if what you're launching is really what people need. I mean, so there's a difference between what your vision for the product is and what you're able to deliver on day one. And there's a lot of people who are going to be willing to put up with the early access bugs and the lack of features and functionality that you just aren't going to be able to have on day one. And then there's going to be this large category of other people who are not willing to wait and they don't want to because they've got a problem right this second that they need solved, and they need to have either you solve it or somebody else. And if you can't solve it right then and there for them, they're not going to be willing to wait. So I think that this point kind of drives home the idea that there's this certain classification of customers or prospects that you have to have early on that are going to be willing to work through whatever those issues are over whatever that time frame happens to be for you to get to a point where you can deliver not just everything that they need, but go above and beyond it to the point that you're able to attract and retain these other types of customers.
Another reason that they've said don't rush is that they spend a ton of time upfront solving this problem well. They said there are dozens of competitors that can extract data from simple, well-structured sites, but nobody could tackle the edge cases. ParseHub essentially spent a year. They said they grabbed a random sample of 30 scraping jobs from Odesk, and they told themselves they wouldn't launch publicly until they could handle at least 20 of them, and it took almost a year of development before they hit it. By that time, they built something really unique, right? Really special. That what is their value proposition then? We can scrape sites that no other tool can. Like, we are quite literally the best. We know that no one else can do that. So they had a value prop that they developed through working with real customers over a longer period of time than most startups would be comfortable with. And I haven't done research into ParseHub, but I'm guessing by the fact that they took that much time that they were bootstrapping. Because if they had a big chunk of funding, they probably would have been pushed to hire faster and get bigger faster. But instead, they were really trying to build, in this case, a better product and seeking that product market fit, in essence of building something people wanted. And it took them a long time. And it'll very likely take that long when you're doing it as well. So the second tip they offer is to perform extensive user testing with potential customers. They said they did more than 50 hours of user tests. And they said almost every change to their product was hinted at by what users did during an interview. They had friends, coworkers, and friends of friends use the product while they watched. They found potential customers on marketplaces like Elance and Odesk and People Per Hour. They interviewed early adopters. They tested usability. They did all that stuff and they asked questions. Here's a few sample questions they asked. What web scraping techniques and tools did you try? What did you like or dislike about them? What kind of websites do you want to get data from? What do you need the data for? Is that data essential for your business? And so they said they focused on solving the customer's problems and they spent a ton of time doing it. So again, this is part of the don't rush. It's like, do it well. Don't try to short circuit this part of the process. We're all in a hurry and we're all impatient and we want to get there, but realize that investing the time now will yield dividends if you really nail it in this early stage.
I think the point of what they're trying to get at here is specifically that if you know what the customer wants before you try and build it, then you can design towards the customer expectations, not what you think that they want, and then try to match it up later, at which point you're going to have to go back and adjust for whatever that gap is between what you thought they wanted and what they actually were looking for. And that's going to hold true regardless of whether or not you're using the tool. And I think that if you are using, like, whatever the type of tool is that you're building, if you're that in that target market, then you're probably more prone to maybe make some assumptions about what the customer really wants. And that can be very difficult to adjust for the gap between where you ended up versus what they were really looking for, what they really needed.
And the third tip they lend is to build something people will pay for. So very much like building something people want. And I think the way they phrase it is they say provide value that customers are willing to pay for. In their post, they say finding a problem is great, but is it a problem that your customers are willing to part with their hard-earned cash to solve? They said before they had a product, they would go on Odesk every day and apply for web scraping jobs. They asked people to commit to $150 a month for a tool they could use themselves. And once they got a few commitments, then they were sure there was a need to actually build software. And they point out that customers will pay you if you help them make money. We've said this many, many times on the podcast. Help them make money, help them save money, help them save time. And, you know, they found a product that, in essence, does all three.
I think it's very easy to kind of skip this particular piece of it and think that you've got this problem that needs to be solved and it needs to be solved so people are going to be willing to pay for it. And it's really a matter of whether or not they're going to be willing to pay you for it. And the other side of it is whether you're going to be able to find additional people who are also willing to pay for that. Back in late fall, when I started the process on Bluetick, there was actually another idea that I was looking at. And I really thought that that was the one that I was going to be able to find traction with and get customers for, and it turned out that it wasn't. It was an interesting problem. I think that there was a lot of money to be made there, but I don't know as I would have been able to actually make that work because I couldn't find enough people that were essentially a critical mass that would have been able to develop into a customer channel. So I think that you have to have those conversations with people and find enough of them early on. And if you can't go through the process and find even just 10 or 20 people who are willing to pay you for it, then what's going to make you think that you're going to get 100 or 500 or 1,000? So if you're trying to think of yourself, oh, well, that's a lot of work, I don't want to do that. Well, you're not going to really be able to build a business if you don't do that to begin with. So you have to take a little bit of a step back and at least just take a baby step in that direction. Try and find this core group of users that you're going to target. And if you can't find them, you're probably not going to be able to scale that into a viable business.
Their fourth tip is to leverage marketplaces and communities. And with ParseHub, these guys focused on Elance and Odesk, but they specifically have a couple questions you should ask yourself. Number one, where does my customer spend his or her time online? Two, where does he or she look to find a solution for the problem I am trying to solve? And they give a couple good examples. They say, if you're running a business that can help jewelry designers sell more product, reach out to them on Etsy. If you want to solve a pain point in the real estate market, you can try Kijiji, Realtor.com, and other industry-specific communities. If you're developing a solution for teachers, you can find them on Udemy or Skillshare.com. And the idea here is that if you can find a community or a marketplace, you're not looking to scale it up to a bazillion users at this point. What you're trying to do is get early feedback, right? And it gives you a little bit of exposure to people who are experiencing a pain point pretty dramatically. And if you're solving that, you are going to get some interest from folks. And that's the point, is you're looking for 5, 10, 15 people at this point, which the reason the title of this episode is how to get your first 10 SaaS customers. So you're doing stuff that doesn't scale very well at all, but that's the point, is you're just trying to hone in on their needs at this point so that you can solve them. And then you look to scale it later and you look to replicate that out and expand it.
One of the things that I really like that they did, that they kind of alluded to in this particular article, which was they went out to places like Elance and Odesk and looked specifically for job postings to solve this particular problem. And they used those to help build their software because it was evident from those job postings that people wanted that particular problem solved and they were willing to pay the money right this second for it. So I think it's worth going out there and taking a look at those different types of sites to find out if there are active job postings to solve the problem that it is that you're trying to solve. And that might also be a good place to just leverage to find ideas as well. I mean, if there's enough people that are paying for a particular job over and over and over again, or a particular problem they need solved, then you could, in theory, build software that is going to solve that problem for them. And maybe you're not going to be able to sell it to them because they need the solution right this second. But down the road, if they need that problem solved again, or if there are other people who also come across that particular problem, you can get them into a sales funnel and solve it later for them.
Yeah, I agree. It's a hack I don't know that I've heard about before, but it totally makes sense. These aren't going to be easy things to solve. I mean, imagine going on to Odesk and getting the list of all the people who want something extracted and then looking at those sites. I bet a bunch of them were really nasty because I bet they had already tried all the solutions available on the market. And so you're going to have to do some hard work here, right? You're going to have to solve a hard problem. But that's the nice part, is that you're going to be able to charge for that if you are, in fact, able to solve it. I mean, I get the feeling so many of us as engineers or of the engineering mindset or even just the entrepreneurial mindset, once you have a problem, you really want to tear into it. But it's just finding that problem that people are willing to pay for, even if it's hard and you're willing to spend 6 months of nights and weekends, or as these guys spent a year of customer development time, finding the problem and vetting it is perhaps as challenging or more so than solving it itself. The fifth tip from ParseHub is to engage on Q&A sites like Quora and Stack Overflow. And they talk about how they answered questions on Quora and Stack Overflow about web scraping, and that this had a measurable impact on their revenues, especially in the early days. They also talk about launching on Hacker News, Reddit, and Product Hunt, which I think these days most people would probably try to do, and they talk a little bit about. But I like the Quora approach, which they reference. There's a Quora how-to guide by Kissmetrics, and they talk about how there's 40 underrated niche sites where you can post about your startup and you can engage about that. This is, I'll say, it's a somewhat common approach. It's not, you know, completely novel or new, but if you can get on Quora, Stack Overflow, and you do provide value and you can answer questions because you're just so deep, by this time you're such an expert in your topic that probably off the top of your head, you have more knowledge than 99%+ of the people on the site. And so you actually can, off the top of your head, answer stuff with really in-depth numbers or thoughts or metrics because it's just something you're living and breathing. I have seen this with my products, you know, whether it's Drip Today or Hittail previously. I have seen getting customers from these types of things, because what's interesting is these aren't just forums off in the corners of the internet. These are big sites with a lot of traffic, and the people who search for these questions are desperately seeking an answer. And so if you can provide a good answer to it, it doesn't even need to be one that the answer is, oh, use my product. The answer can often just be, here's some insight, here's some metrics. By the way, I learned this as the founder of this product. And it lends you that credibility. I like this approach.
The other thing that's nice about that is, as you said, I mean, these sites have lots and lots of traffic, and it's not just the immediate traffic from the people who are asking the questions. It's more the long-term traffic over the course of a year or 2 years or 5 years, because those answers that you left several months or years ago will continue to be searched and indexed, and people are going to look for those because the same questions on forums tend to come up over and over and over again. So even on Quora, you'll find that the same types of questions keep getting asked, and they keep getting answered. And even on Stack Overflow, to some extent, there's a lot of times where there will be one canonical answer. And that's really what the community there strives to try and do. But a lot of times there's variations of a particular answer, and you can go in and you can answer them. And as Rob said, you just drop some notes. Hey, I learned this as the founder of X. And people will go through those and they'll take a look at it. And if they still need the problem solved, or if they still have questions, I mean, they'll click through and they will end up at your site. And hopefully that will lend itself towards another marketing channel. But I do know people who've been using Quora to some degree of success to try and help push their sales funnel further.
Yeah, and you might think that, you know, Quora doesn't scale, and it's not going to scale infinitely, but you see entire brands built just on answering Quora questions, like with Jason Lemkin and Saster. I mean, he says that's how he built pretty much the core of the Saster brand, and he's answered thousands, I'm sure you can look and see how many he's answered, but thousands of Quora questions, and he's become kind of the de facto guy to be talking about, you know, B2B SaaS and how to grow that because of that. So while you may not have the time to do that, if you're able to answer questions up front and then later on, you know, you can use the approach that Stelly does at Closed.io, where he says they'll often put out a blog post, and then he basically records a video, and then they turn it into both a video, audio, and a blog post. And then the kind of the editor, the guy who's helping him do the content production, reads the post and gets the ideas out of it and goes on to Quora and figures out, are there questions that pieces of this post answer? And then we'll answer it, whether it's posting it all on Quora or linking back. I'm not exactly sure how they do it. But there can be value that is a somewhat scalable thing, because it's not using Stelly's time anymore. And you're now using someone else to continue offering a lot of value to the audience and answering questions that they want answered to, and in effect, getting some of that value back by the handful of people who are going to click back and potentially check out your product. So the sixth and final tip from Parse Hub about how to get your first 10 SaaS customers is to use Twitter. And specifically, they say that Twitter works magic, and so do your first few loyal fans. They talk about how they had a few users give them positive shoutouts on Twitter, and that after their initial launch, someone noticed them and reached out to write about them. And to quote, the author says he wrote an honest comparison between Parse Hub and Komodo Labs, and he included the pros and cons of the first version of Parse Hub. So I agree. I mean, I have this love-hate, mostly hate relationship with Twitter and Facebook for that matter. You need to use your head when you're doing this, right? You can't be on Twitter all the time, in my opinion. You need to be running your business. But he's right that monitoring Twitter and engaging with folks, especially in the early days, will earn you fans. It can earn you press. I'd say it's more important in this early stage as you're starting to get momentum. And he indicates that the opinion of your first few users matters more than gold. Reach out to them, ask for their feedback, engage them in your story, because then they become advocates of yours. And if they like you and they like what you're doing, they're the ones who are going to help spread the word. And so engaging with them on Twitter is one way of doing that. Via email is another. The nice part about Twitter, of course, is that it's public. And if folks are asking you questions or high-fiving you, essentially, virtually through Twitter, that's a nice way to engage and kind of, I guess, broaden your reach, so to speak.
That's also a double-edged sword, because if their experience was a negative one, then, of course, it's out there publicly for the entire world to see throughout all of human history at this point.
But most people, like, if you really are working with them and they have a negative experience, they tend to do it via email, especially right in the early days when you're really hands-on. I would hope that you could handle that one-on-one and
sure
help them move along. But you're right, it is a danger.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I won't say I take issue with this so much as really, like, I don't think that Twitter is a silver bullet for every single business. I think it's great that it worked for them, and it's great that they were able to land an honest review between them and somebody else. But that's certainly not going to happen to everybody. I mean, in some ways, it was a lucky coincidence. But in other ways, if you are really working hand in hand with a lot of customers over the course of a year to build your product, then that's going to happen naturally on its own, regardless of whether it's Twitter or some other place.
Yeah, I would would agree with that. That's a good point to raise. There is absolutely some serendipity in this. I think there are ways to tip that serendipity in your favor by providing amazing support and a hand-holding experience up front. I think if possible, working with influencers, whether you're hand-picking them or whether you're just lucking into them, that's always a big one, right? Because anyone with an email list or big Twitter following, they tend to want to create content to send to that list. And if you really knock their socks off, it often gives people an excuse to talk about you. It's not a surefire thing for sure. And you're going to spend a lot of time that's never going to yield anything, but at least ParseHub in their early days said that they used it to great effect, or at least to get them to that 10 customer mark. And I think if you did all of their other things and didn't use Twitter, I think you'd be just fine. I think Twitter is more of an icing on the cake if you're already there and you know your audience is there as well, and that is going to be a viable channel, then I think it's something to think about. But I wouldn't prioritize it as high as any of the other points we've spoken about.
Right. But I think that's more because it's so dependent upon those other things. I think that your comment about icing on the cake, I think that that's very true, just because of the fact that if you do all of the other things, then Twitter will work well, or Facebook, or, you know, showing off your stuff publicly is going to work well because you've already worked with customers a lot. You've seen exactly what they're looking for and what they're willing to pay for, and you've done all of those other things. And it eventually leads you down the road of being more public about your stuff and being more public about your interactions and the success that your customers are having, which then leads to these other things and these other success marks, like the unbiased reviews and things like that, that you can then highlight. So it becomes something of a snowball effect at that point. Whereas if you were to start out with Twitter, for example, it just wouldn't work because there's nothing to base it on. You don't even know if you have a viable product yet, or you're solving a real problem that people have. So I feel like this, it's not just the last on the list because it just happened to fall there, but because it naturally falls there. It has to, because all of the other things have to be in place in order for that to really work well for you.
So again, we'll link up the full blog post in the show notes, and hopefully you enjoyed this look today into how to get your first 10 paying SaaS customers.
I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforusfist.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsforusfist.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.